Right, well, I've arrived at South Wanston Village Hall. We're about 4 or 5 miles from Winchester in Hampshire. I'm here to speak at a public meeting, which is being held inside. I'm actually not entirely certain what the format for this is, whether I'm meant to make a speech or just take questions or something. So I'm going to pop in, see what's going on, and see how we get on.
Right, our first speaker is Ray Finch. Ray was a telecom engineer for 20 years, but he's always taken an interest in current affairs and politics, and he's watched all the usual programmes. And one day, his wife got fed up with him shouting at the television, and she told him to go and do something. So he did. And he was, in short order, he was elected to Hampshire County Council. It wasn't long before he was the group leader of UKIP within Hampshire County Council. And in that position, one of the things that he did, he embarrassed the Labour grouping within the council by working with the trades unions to try and prevent the closure of dementia homes. He was unsuccessful, and unfortunately in that, but at least he tried, and that is hardly the sort of thing that you'd expect from somebody who David Cameron described as a, well, people who support UKIP are often described as loonies. Well, that's part of the behaviour of a loon. In 2014, Ray was elected UKIP MEP for the South East region of England. And this is where it gets interesting. He's the fisheries spokesman, so he is quite an expert on the damage that's been done to our fishing industry by our membership with the European Union, and it is pretty awful. And he's written a number of booklets, but these two are specifically about the damage that's been done to completely innocent, very poor third world countries, African countries, by EU fisheries policy. It is an absolute disgrace. So please take these home and read them and tell people about them, because people don't even know what's going on. It is an absolute disgrace. So that's enough from me. Please welcome Ray Finch.
Thank you, everyone. Good afternoon. Anyone got a chip for the Grand National? I'm not sure. Anyway,
dusty carpet, never been beaten.
What was it?
Dusty carpet, never been beaten.
You've been watching too many Carry On movies. Right. I know I'm slated here to talk about the about fishery policy, but the fact is, over the last few months, something's come along that's much more important in the short term, and we can't do anything about fisheries policy without dealing with this first. What we're trying to do now is we're trying to change the entire world. You, me, everyone involved in this. Make no mistake, that's what will happen. This vote to free ourselves from the European Union, if we're successful, will change the entire world. All of the other various supranational organisations are all following the EU with what it does in dragging virtually every nation in the world into this corporatist hell. You know, it'll be an absolute hellhole if we fail. And that's why what we're doing now is so important. June the 23rd is the day to save nation state democracy across the world, not just for ourselves. Let's talk about how this campaign's being fought now. From the inners, it's all fear-mongering. They're spending all their time trying to panic the British people with their scare stories. They're getting their friends in big business to even write to their employees, as they did in the previous referendum, I can see some of you will remember that. Even in the last referendum campaign in 75, they did the same. They got their friends in big business to write to their members, to their staff, and tell them they'll all lose their jobs if we leave what was then the common market. The people who make minis, they've had a letter from their bosses to frighten them into voting to stay. But in the words of Mandy Rice Davis, they would say that, wouldn't they? they're owned by BMW. Once we leave, and we will, Germany will have to pay more to subsidise the failing and failed states of southern Europe, like Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, that have been brought actually to their knees by this political adventurism that is the euro currency. It's a currency that was explicitly built to keep the Deutschmark cheap. So why should we pay more and more to prop up economies designed that are being destroyed to build the German manufacturing base? If the German currency is so strong, they can always move it here. So that seems fair to me. Ford have done the same. Now Ford, this is something very close to my heart. In 2010, I was the UKIP candidate for Eastleigh in the general election. And at the time, Ford were closing down their transit plant in Swaveland, which is just at the edge of the Eastleigh constituency. And what happened with that? Very interesting. Ford were given an £80 million loan from the European Investment Bank, which is your money, it's European taxpayers' money, to move production of the transits to Turkey, not even in the EU, but it is the EU's next member state. David Cameron himself, he was in Ankara last year, and he said he's there to make the case for Turkey to join the EU. And he would be Turkey's strongest proponent for this. Now, you know, we all know the problems that we've got ongoing in the EU at the moment with migration. Turkey has borders with Iraq, Iran and Afghanistan. If we stay in, they'll be our borders. That's what they will be. Ford have now applied for another £100 million loan from the European Investment Bank to build more plants in Turkey. You can guess where the jobs from there will be going. We'll lose more jobs. Those Ford workers who are now being told to stay in the EU, to vote to stay in the EU, will lose their jobs while Ford move it again to Turkey. As we've already heard, the government spent 9.3 million of our money to bring out this booklet to tell everybody how scary it will be if we leave. Now, the Europe Minister, David Lidington, he told the House of Commons in June 2015, and this is quote, "We have no intention of legislating to allow the government to do things such as mail shots, paid advertising, or leaflet." So they lie. They lie, lie, and lie again. They're just like liars. Now this shows that the fear and mendacity that propels the In campaign. Now if you're going to be talking about mendacity, lying to those of us who don't have a university education, I'm going to talk about Mr. Cameron. When he proposed the referendum, he told us if we did not get the results he wanted from his negotiations, then he would have no hesitation in recommending a Leave vote. And now he talks about how utterly disastrous it will be for us if we vote for Brexit. You know, does this mean he was prepared to lead us down a path to ruin if he didn't get his way in negotiations? That man is a preposterous liar with no principles, and if anyone in this room doesn't appreciate me saying it, so be it. This In case is built entirely on fear. It's a Grimm's fairy tale constructed to keep the children from opening the wardrobe to be scared of the bogeyman that's hiding behind it. It's a phantasm, respect that. It's no more than that. We have, as Roosevelt said, nothing to fear but fear itself. Now let's talk about the positives. What do we have to fear if we leave? A loss of trade with the EU? Ridiculous. Yeah. Ridiculous. For a start, when we leave, we will be the EU's biggest export market. Would they be stupid enough, given that the EU is run specifically by and for the interests of big business, to cast adrift their biggest customer? Of course they wouldn't. Last year, the UK had a €51 billion trade deficit with Germany alone. And you remember earlier I talked about BMW writing its blackmail letter to the workers in the mini plant? Many of the parts of the mini come from Germany. 40% of the British cars on the road now come from Germany. and 21% of household electrical appliances do so, including 40% of all dishwashers. 50%, sorry. Are the owners of Bosch, Siemens, Volkswagen, Mercedes, going to turn around and say, oh, we won't sell any of our lovely goods to these nasty Britishers because they're leaving the club? Of course not. They're not mad. They'll be kicking down Angela Merkel's door and telling her in no uncertain terms that they want continued free access to this huge market. German manufacturing didn't get so powerful by allowing mere politicians to kick them. German manufacturing does the kicking in Europe. The fact of the matter is, the In campaign said we'll be isolating ourselves. This actually brings to mind, and I thought of it this morning as I was finishing the speech. There's a possibly apocryphal headline from a British newspaper during the 20s. Said, fog falls, continent cut off. It's a huge world out there. The countries now in the EU had approximately 30% of world trade when we joined what was then a common market. By the end of this decade, it'll be half of that. The EU isn't the future, the EU is the past. The future's out there, and a United Kingdom free of its chains can work more closely with the rest of the world, creating its own deals with the rest of the world. At the moment, when the EU negotiates a trade deal, we've got to queue up with 27 other nations to get our views across. It's like going to a restaurant with 27 other people and you can all only have the same set meal. Often you'll get something on your plate that's not entirely to your taste. Sometimes it will be unpalatable. And occasionally it will be poisonous. Bilateral trade agreements give a nation an opportunity to make a deal, which is what it wants and needs, rather than what someone else wants and needs. One of the major opportunities of the EU will be to reunite with our friends and our brothers in the Commonwealth. These are the people who have the same language, the same legal and business trade laws that we have. They're the people who fought and died alongside us to preserve the freedom in this world. And we abandon them when we join the common market, and we need to reconnect with them. We also have a chance to help the third world. Things like trade with African countries. At the moment, Africa is an aid drain. We pour money in to keep people alive, whilst EU trade agreements stop these nations developing. One of the most pernicious of these trade laws is the trade in coffee. The EU trade agreements on raw coffee has no tariff. However, for processed coffee, which is what we all end up using, it's between 20 and 30% variance on what type it is. And this means that in 2014, unprocessed coffee earned African nations 2.4 billion in exports. But German exports of processed coffee was 3.6 billion. This stops African nations developing their own industries and leaves it as merely a supplier of raw goods. The agreements on cocoa are even more onerous, the tariffs for those are between 30 and 60%. Wouldn't it be so much better if we can help Africa to help itself? We've got a real future outside the EU. We're the fifth largest economy in the world. We can be a positive force for good, and we can restore nation-state democracy and free trade. We can be the good guys, and we can bring peace and prosperity rather than being part of an empire that's only creating stagnation and instability around the world. Ronald Reagan, when he was getting elected, he wanted to paint a picture of a big, shining city on a hill. Now, a free and independent United Kingdom can be that big, shining city on a hill. We need to go out and on June the 23rd, vote for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. Our next speaker, Rupert Matthews. Now, Rupert's worked mostly in publishing and has written nearly 200 books, which is quite astonishing. I wish I'd written one. and mostly on historical but other subjects as well. And he regularly contributes to magazines and newspapers, local and national. He served as a councillor and he has stood as a parliamentary candidate for Westminster and the European Union. This is where it gets interesting. He worked, when he was working at Conservative Central Office in the campaigns department, he read the Maastricht Treaty.
More than the MPs ever did.
He was so horrified by the contents of that document that he decided there and then that we need to leave the European Union. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bruce Matthews, campaign manager.
Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'll start by saying that over there we've got some leaflets and booklets and car stickers and badges and stuff. Please help yourself. I don't want to take any of it home. Okay? However, the second thing I've got to say is this is about the fourth time I've stood up and spoken after Ray. And for the fourth time, he's already given all my best lines and covered half the subjects I was going to talk about. So, I hope you'll forgive me if I sort of lurch on slightly. Now, where we are here, of course, we're not very far from Winchester. And in Winchester, you've got that great statue of King Alfred, who did so much to protect England against the Vikings and to free us from foreign domination. And make no mistake about it, on the 23rd of June, what we are going to do will be just as historic as what Alfred the Great did, because we are going to be freeing our country from foreign rule. The European Union is not like other bodies like the Commonwealth or NATO, which we belong to. In fact, believe it or not, Britain belongs to 78 different international organisations. With all of those, we join, we make certain agreements about what we're going to do, and we get on and do it. But with the European Union, they take precedence over us. Any laws or regulations that are passed in Brussels automatically overrule any laws that are passed in Westminster. Now, there are different estimates as to what proportion of the laws that we currently have to obey have come from Brussels. I've heard estimates ranging anywhere between about 45% and 75%. But the point being that increasingly, we're being told what to do by other people. And it's not just that we're being told what to do by people in Brussels. We're being told what to do by people that we cannot elect, we cannot get rid of, and who have absolutely no responsibility to us at all. Tony Benn, I think, he hit the nail on the head when he said, if you cannot vote out of office the people who rule you, you do not live in a democratic system. Yeah. Under the current system of the European Union, ultimate power rests in Brussels with the European Commission. Now, I know Ray does a splendid job in the European Parliament, but I'm sure he would be the first to acknowledge that the European Parliament itself holds relatively little power. And while we can elect Ray, and hopefully you'll be able to join in June, but nothing personal, we cannot elect or get rid of the commissioners who are really holding the power. So if you want to live in a democracy, if you want to be able to vote for the people who rule you, you've really got to vote Leave on the 23rd of June. I'm also going to touch on something else. The people who campaign for In, as both previous speakers have said, are generally relying on Project Fear. They're saying how scary it is. It's a leap in the dark. You don't know what you're going for. One of the reasons we don't know exactly what Britain will be like after we leave the European Union is because the European Union has refused to say what sort of trade deal they will offer us. So it's a bit like them saying, I'm not going to tell you what the future's like. In the future, scary. It's not intellectually coherent, and we should ignore them. As Ray has said, we are going to be the largest export market for the European Union, and they will have to offer us a trade deal of some description. Indeed, it is written into their very constitution that they will have trade deals with all neighbouring countries. So either they've got to break their own law or they've got to deal with it. But the idea that the European Union is good for jobs, something which our opponents are peddling, could not be further from the truth. Ray, of course, looks after British fishermen from UKIP's point of view here. I'm sure he'll be able to give you chapter and verse. I think I'm right in saying that the at-sea workforce of the British fishing industry went from about 24,000 before we joined to about 10,000 now. And the onshore jobs of, you know, the fish processing, looking after the boats, providing fishing gear and so on, has collapsed by even more. I think that's down about 70% or something. So the European Union imposed a fishing policy on us, which cost us tens of thousands of jobs. They are currently imposing on us a policy which is costing our steel industry tens of thousands of jobs. The aluminium industry is also about to collapse. We smelted 300,000 tonnes of aluminium 6 years ago. We now smelt less than 50,000 tonnes of aluminium. And the only large smelting plant that's left is now threatened with closure. And the only reason we're not all up in arms about that is because steel is even worse. And looking across Europe as a whole, if the European Union was so good for jobs, then the rest of Europe should be in full employment. Everyone should be happy. Everyone should have jobs. The unemployment rate in Greece at the moment is nearly 30%. Youth unemployment in Greece is at 50%. And it's not just Greece. Spain has got an unemployment rate of 14%. Youth unemployment is in the high 20s. Portugal has got an unemployment rate of 22%. Youth unemployment there is 44%. There are numerous countries in Europe where the European Union policies are actually causing hardship and unemployment, because by joining the euro, those countries can no longer change their interest rate or change their exchange rate or allow their currency to float or print more money or print less money. And all the things that independent countries can do, they can no longer do. They are having to obey the diktats from Brussels, and unemployment is the result. I will close. I could have gone on for a bit longer, but he's already said most of this. I will close only by giving a little viewpoint of my own on this. As you've heard, I work in publishing, I write history books and so on. The European Union was founded back in the 1950s with the express intention of stopping war between France and Germany. Rivalry between France and Germany had led to European War in 1870, 1914, and 1939. That was a noble ambition. The route that was chosen to do that was to take what they called the sinews of war, iron, coal, and steel, out of democratic control of the democratic governments of France and Germany, and give it to a new body, the nascent European Union, which was not democratically controlled. It was deliberately set up not to be democratically controlled, which had superiority over France and Germany and deliberately designed to do so. Now, in that narrow job, it has succeeded. But over the intervening decades and generations, more and more power has been shifted from the democratically elected national governments to the undemocratic, unaccountable bodies in Brussels. It is time to call an end to that. It is time for Britain to go out into the world as an independent, democratic, prosperous nation and engage with the world, not be trapped within the declining, failing European Union. Please vote Leave.
Now, questions and answers. Direct a question. If you ask a question to Ray or Rupert, and I'll answer it.
Yes, sir. Armed forces, sir.
Yeah.
Our armed forces. By pulling out the European hope to get out on the 23rd of June and keeping our armed services, if it goes the other way, and we say, what will happen with our army, air force, and navy?
Well, already, the fact is, if the Isle of Wight chooses to Chelsea attackers, now the Navy probably couldn't defend us. I think we've got something like 14 warships, if that, maybe less. The fact is, if you remember, when Nigel Farage did a debate with Nick Clegg, which for Nick Clegg was the longest suicide known in history, he said at the time, Nigel said, we're heading towards an EU army. Nick Clegg said that was an absolute lie, no one was speaking about that at all. A couple of weeks later, I was in the Parliament building and I took a picture of a poster that was run by Nick Clegg's group in it, ALDE, the Association of Liberal Democrats in Europe. Neither Liberal nor very democratic, I think, but there you go. And it said, towards an EU army. So they're lying about it. You know, at the moment they are trying their very best to remove the power of nation states to defend themselves and to incorporate them into an EU military. Personally, I think the fact that we went ahead with two aircraft carriers without any aircraft to put on them was part of that idea, because it means the only people really in Europe who have aircraft that will fit on them are the French. And the likelihood is they're going to be taking on those aircraft carriers.
Well, just coming back to that, as an ex-serviceman, when I took my oath to defend the Queen and the country.
Yep.
Right. And I like to think that is exactly what we did when I was in the army. And I'm very proud of that. And as an Englishman, that we need to protect our army and our soldiers. We used to be Royal Britannia, didn't we? Rule the waves. And I think we need that back. So,
Well, you know, the problem we've got now with the army, I mentioned the Navy just before, the army, a couple of weeks' time, Everton, my club, are going to be playing in the semi-final of the FA Cup at Wembley. I bring him up whenever I can, he don't get much of this. Our army would now fit into the stands at Wembley. 80,000 people. 80,000 people.
240, isn't it?
There you go. And that wasn't that long ago, was it? I mean, no. So, you know, essentially what's happening is all of the attributes of a nation state have been removed from us, one by one. And frankly, where we are, we're not defending our country anymore anyway. We're being pushed into, and this is separate items, pushed into wars in which we have no place. There's no reason we should be fighting in the Middle East. No reason whatsoever. All it does is create more enemies for us, causes our people to lose their lives unnecessarily. And as far as I'm concerned, Tony Blair's a war criminal, and we should be locked up. That's by the way.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Next question, sir.
A lot of us realise that this referendum is going to be non-binding. You know where I'm going with this, don't you? A few years ago, the Irish had a vote on the Lisbon Treaty, and they rejected it. 18 months later, they forced a yes vote. Do you think the same thing could happen? And of course, bear in mind that they had the euro still in the euro, were not.
I'll do this one if I may. You're quite right that the referendum on June 23rd is non-binding. That's because of the constitutional setup in this country, that in theory, the Crown in Parliament is sovereign, and therefore all decisions have to be made by the House of Commons, House of Lords, and then Royal Assent. However, I think that given the importance of this, and given the big hype and the build-up and everything to it, when we vote to leave on June 23rd, and I'm pretty confident we will, I think a number of things are going to happen very, very quickly. I think that David Cameron will be out of Downing Street within days. That will then, of course, trigger a leadership election within the Conservative Party. Now, the way those things are meant to happen is that the current leader stays in office for about 2 or 3 months while they go through all their long big role and they end up at party conference in October. I don't think that will happen. I think what will happen is that the notorious men in grey suits will get together and will choose a leader whose sole and only job will be to negotiate our leaving the European Union. So I think that will happen within a matter of days. We will get a new Prime Minister. Most of the government machinery will shudder to a halt, and all effort will be put into the two-year process of getting us out of the European Union. I spend a lot of my time talking to Conservative members of Parliament, which I know Ray always finds slightly bizarre with me, but it's part of my job to do so. And they have consistently told me that, as far as they are concerned, this referendum is binding, and it is the only referendum. I know there has been talk about a second referendum. That's mainly been coming from what I suppose we might call the lukewarm Leave Brigade, those people who sort of think, well, the European Union is not perfect, but oh dear, I'm not sure. That sort of person. And their idea is that we would vote to leave and then would use that as a mandate to go back and get some real reforms going on. Well, Britain's been trying to reform the European Union for years. John Major, didn't know the master of it, said, game, set and match. Tony Blair said, the European Union's moving in our direction. And David Cameron came back and said he'd achieved significant reforms. I mean, the whole concept is awful. I mean, nothing is certain, it must be said. The only thing I think is certain is that if we get a good-sized majority, and by that I mean over 10%, then there is absolutely no doubt we will be out of the European Union and we will be out within 2 years and there will be absolutely no backsliding at all. If the majority is only 1%, I'm quite sure those lukewarmers might try something on. So is it, you know, for those of us who want to leave, we've got to campaign hard and we've got to make sure we get a thumping majority.
Can I just say something before we go to the next question? Anybody who wants to know what David Cameron claimed that he would achieve in these so-called renegotiations, if you Google Bloomberg's speech, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? If you Google Bloomberg's speech and you have a read of that very extensive document that he produced, and it's quite impressive actually. He might have won this if he had achieved 5% what's in that document. I'll repeat it, Bloomberg's speech. He hasn't achieved any of it, it's a joke.
Absolutely.
Next question.
Yes, sir. And then you.
Yes, if we finally do come out of the EU, what do you think the future for the EU itself is? Do you think that the rest of the other countries will follow us?
Yes. I think the Dutch referendum on the EU-Ukraine treaty was a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah.
It wasn't about Ukraine. I've spoken to many Dutch people in the parliament, if you can call the parliament.
It's still a parliament.
And circus then, that'll do. And none of them believe that it's about that at all. You find over 50% of the people in France now won a referendum. And you know, France, along with Germany, is one of the biggest supporters, historically, of it. And you find it everywhere. Once our money goes, and don't forget, all of these things are about money. Germany will more or less be the only one who's actually paying it, to a great extent anyway. And once those countries, the poorer countries particularly, finally get less money, there'll be less reason. They'll become more unstable. What it will be, unfortunately, I believe, is it'll be as if you're in a cinema and someone shouts fire. The ones who hear fire first and get out the door will be relatively unscathed. The ones who are stuck at the back are in trouble. I think that's how it's going to happen. It's unfortunate. But the EU will fail anyway. It's an empire, as Barroso once said. And the fate of all empires is death. So, there you go. Hope that helps. So, you'll let
yes,
the gentleman next.
Well, firstly, I'd like to thank both Ray and Rupert for your impassioned presentations. But it's a real observation that on this lead-up to the vote, only the 23rd of June, there's nobody that I can see that's standing up and actually putting the points that you're putting across the nation. All of the media, and the other word, is the fear campaign that must end. So the question to you is, why aren't we doing more?
Well, we are.
Help us.
In this very minute. The problem is we don't control media. The media is controlled by the elite. If you go back to the 1975 referendum, and Rupert knows this better than me, what happened? Every Friday, you're on there, you're on the list, members of the government, members of MI5, and those who control the media, had a meeting in, I think it was the Commonwealth Hotel, was it?
Yeah.
In London? And they decided what the media for the next week regarding the referendum would be. They can't do it so much now because we have the internet, because we have much, much better social media than we ever had there. You know, back then, you had the BBC, you had ITV, and you had the newspapers, all of which were boxed off. Now they're not. You know, most of the media that I do, funnily enough, is for non-British media. But we can get all that here. We can get Russia Today. We can get any number of foreign European TV channels at any time. And we also have social media. So they don't want us on there. But, you know, I can tell you now, Nigel's in Bournemouth, East Bournemouth. Is it Bournemouth Today? One of them. He's bimbling around the country all the time. Doing a huge meeting. So we're talking to the people. They're talking to the media. You know, we don't really have that reach because they don't like us very much.
No. Can I just chip in here? As National Campaign Manager of Better Off Out, I move in slightly different circles. I may move in slightly different circles to me, so you know, we sort of see different sides of this. The Stay In campaign is incredibly well funded. We know they've taken money from Goldman Sachs. We know that they've taken money from some other multinational corporations. We've been trying to keep a check on what they're spending. And the caricature is, it's not entirely true, but it is broadly, they've got all the money and we've got all the people. They've done two mail shots since Christmas. Which were paid delivery, so they went out with the Royal Mail. Okay, those have cost the In campaign something in the region of £5 million for the printing and the distribution. Okay, we don't have that sort of money. Nobody on our team does. So we rely on volunteers and activists to man street stalls. I was in Bitton shopping centre this morning. Getting very wet, manning a street stall there. I've been out delivering leaflets and so on. Because we have people who will do work, we don't have the money. And so what tends to be happening, as Ray said, the media notice the big high profile spend and the press officers and so on, and the media consultants that the In campaign can afford. Whereas we're relying on getting things through doors and standing in shopping centres talking to people. So we're running two different sorts of campaign, which is forced on us by the fact we don't have a lot of money, but we have got a lot of volunteers. Whereas they're sort of almost boxed into theirs. They can't run our sort of campaign because they just don't have the volunteers to do it, but they do have shed loads of money that they can spend on other things. And this is having the unfortunate effect that Ray's talking about the media are taking more attention of them because they're getting phone calls from professional media, press release officers, you know, the whole time. Like, oh, did you get our press release? Or are you going to cover the speech by Lord Mandelson? What do you think about this, that and the other? You know, they can outspend us and they are outspending us massively. Now, that's going to stop once the official campaign starts because we are both limited in what we can spend. We have already raised the maximum that we are legally allowed to spend. They've got shed loads. Of course, this is why the thing that David Cameron's done is so iniquitous, because we are just about to enter that period where spending should be even, and now suddenly they've got twice as much money as we've got.
And it's your money. So is during this period to come, both Boris and Nigel having a much higher profile?
I can't speak for Nigel, and I haven't spoken to Boris directly. I understand that the idea is that the personalities will be speaking on issues and in places where those personalities will go down best. Now, I'm not senior enough to know exactly what that means. If I was doing it, I would send Nigel around the country with a soapbox to do big public meetings, to stand on street corners and engage with people directly. and I would send Boris around the TV studios. Right? But I'm not in charge, so that might not be what they do.
Okay, thank you, Rupert. Thank you, Randy.
Can I just say something about that? Is don't underestimate your own circle of influence about just engaging your own family and friends in conversation, because I know it's a really jaunty day, but I've always taken an interest in current affairs in this particularly, and just engaging my children and getting them talking about it, that I've managed to convert a lot of people. I'm no expert, I know nothing like the amount of information that you guys know. But don't underestimate just how much influence you can have just by the other people you associate with all, every day, and they consequently go and tell other people.
Absolutely. You're entirely right, but one of the better things that we have is Facebook. I don't use it myself, because you never know when someone's going to put a picture up on my Facebook page, and all of a sudden I'm in the Daily Mail for something I didn't even know about. But when you pass on messages, and we do a lot of this, we do a lot of social media in UK, but it's one of our strengths, it has to be. You put something on Facebook, and you have a circle of people who trust you in a way they don't trust the media. And then it radiates out from there, and they take things that you've said, and then it radiates out from them, because those people trust those people. So that's a valuable asset that we have. And frankly, because the In campaign doesn't really have a groundswell of people, they don't have that. They just have Jon Snow on Channel 4 or other people on Newsnight. Now, there was a lady just over there who wanted to speak.
Oh, yes. You said something about 50% of French people wanted a referendum.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, that is not true as far as I know. People in France don't even know we're having a referendum in UK to leave the EU. They thought we'd probably already left, or we never wanted to be in the UK. So...
There was a poll last week.
That's not true.
There was a poll last week. There was a poll last week. If you want to wait till the end of it, I'm sure I can find it on the internet. There was a poll. Over 50% of people in France wanted it.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Okay.
One moment. There was... Gentleman there, sorry.
Is there any members of the media involved within this room today, of the press, television, or anything like that? Either locally or nationally?
I doubt it. Most of the ones we do.
Are they afraid of the comments that might arise from this meeting?
Well, I didn't even think of notifying the press. This was something local. I thought that occurred to me. There's no reason why they couldn't be here to report this, but I didn't even think of it.
Most of the meetings I do, and I'll probably do 2 or 3 a week at least, we invite the media. Occasionally you'll get someone from the local newspaper. Not often. It'll change. Once we get into the last 28 days of it, you know, you won't be able to drop a pen in public without a journalist.
Thank you.
So you were next after this lady.
Could you say something about the effect of Brexit on farming? I think this is not felt in rural areas, and there's a lot of women going around.
Absolutely. Rupert, do you want this one?
Yeah, I'll do this. You've got the question, if I may. Hello. Farming is one of the industries that is most tightly controlled and influenced by the European Union. Every farmer has to fill in a 36-page form or something about everything they're doing. They have to keep a track on everything. It is very, very tightly controlled. In return for that, the farmers then get... subsidised, considering what they do and where they're doing and so on. So the first thing to say is that we pay into the Common Agricultural Policy about 40% more than is paid back to British farmers. So I think for the first 2 or 3 years after Brexit, it would continue pretty much as it is now, partly because, of course, farming is... an investment-intensive industry. You have to buy your combine harvesters and tractors and all the equipment. And the European Union has been controlling very tightly what crops farmers can grow what they're paid to grow and so on. So it would be unfair to a farmer who has invested a whole load of money in equipment to buy to grow wheat to suddenly say, well, we're scrapping that and grow turnips instead. So there is going to be quite a lengthy overchange on that. However, we can certainly afford to put in as much money into British farming as the European Union does. But we will also, because it would be us doing it, control for the interests of Britain what it is we're asking farmers to do. So we might, for instance, take the view that we want to be more self-sufficient in basic foodstuffs. Or we might take the view, no, actually, you know, it's cheaper to buy from wheat from Canada. Let's grow the stuff that's flown by air miles, so that'll reduce the carbon imprint, footprint. So we'll grow a lot more soft fruit and that sort of stuff. Or we might decide, well, no, actually, the countryside is more like a leisure path for towns. Let's have beautiful fields and long footpaths. But it will be the democratically elected politicians in this country making those decisions. So the answer to your question is, in the long term, I can't tell you. It will be up to the democratically elected British government. But in the short term, there will be very little change at all in the first 2 or 3 years. And I would imagine that farming being the important industry it is, no British government would want to cut the amount of support farmers get and see them all thrown out of work. It's just not going to happen.
Can I just add on to that? Yeah. The farming lobby in the UK is so powerful, so strong. You know, you don't want to upset Prince Charles or the Duke of Westminster. There is no way I could see that any British government would ever reduce the support of farming and presence, because it'd be electoral suicide, frankly. They'd lose so much support. Is that okay?
Yeah, but the
NFU
is very
proud
of the European Union.
Oh, indeed.
Oh, yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, sadly. Our farming spokesman, Stuart Agnew, who's a poultry and something else he does, farmer in Norfolk, he speaks to the NFU all the time, and they say to him, yes, Stuart, you're right, you're absolutely right, but we don't want to lose our subsidies. And he says to them, you're not going to lose the subsidies. And he says, yes, Stuart, you're right, but we don't want to lose our subsidies. So the NFU is in this internal circle. To the lady, the French lady, I've just looked that thing up, and it was in the Daily Express on the 28th of March, and in a poll in France, 53% of French people wanted a referendum. So you could look that up yourself.
Could have done the Express report, so it was a poll made over, 100 people?
I have no idea what to do at the time.
I'll look it up.
By all means, but I wouldn't deliberately tell you something that was incorrect. You're next, sir, after the ladies finish.
I've got another question. How do you feel the 2 years are going to be affecting small businesses who deal with Europe at the moment and rely heavily on Europe for trade?
As I said earlier, the fact is, we're the EU's biggest customer. They will be absolutely insane to want to do anything that harmed that trade relationship, and I don't think they are.
No, they would not want to, but what about the simple daily things? Like, at the moment, it's really easy to deal with Europe. You've got no frontier. If you deal with Turkey, it's a totally different business because they're not in Europe. So obviously, we won't have that situation of being in Europe anymore. What will happen?
During the 2 years while the negotiations take place, we continue with the current regime. That stays exactly as it is.
What happens
for the 2 years, while the negotiations go on. As Ray is saying, quite rightly, that is to negotiate a deal. The Europeans will do a deal with us, and then that will kick in after the 2 years. Everyone will have 2 years to get ready for whatever is going to happen.
So you're next. I know you keep slinging your hand up and you're
Yeah. I mean, I would just add to what the point that was being made a second ago, that even in the last few months, while this campaign about the referendum has been going on, the value of the pound's plummeted by about 10% against the euro, making a lot of foreign holidays that much more expensive. However, my point wasn't about that. You were talking about scare stories earlier.
Yeah.
And I want to pick it up on the scare story you've got here about our brave servicemen being under EU command. Now, As I see it, Britain has very similar objectives in the world to most of the rest of the Western world. And we are currently scaled, and you've already made a point about the number of ships in the Royal Navy, we are not really scaled at the moment to be able to undertake anything above a really minor operation anywhere else in the world without being in with our allies. Now, we already have a place called the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps. We have that organisation, which fronts up both NATO and EU operations. It's headquartered in Gloucester. It's commanded by a three-star general who's British. It has a second-in-command who's Italian. The chief of staff is also British. Now, if we vote for Brexit, we're going to lose that EU element there. And because,
why would we lose that if it's part of NATO as well?
We will still have it for NATO, but if we want to go it alone with other organisations within Europe, for instance, like we did in the Balkans, all right, then we will be part of the rest of Europe, a European coalition put together, and we can then guarantee that that will be managed out of the rest of Europe, and we will have our people under EU control. Now, if you find that bad, and I'm not sure I do, but if you don't like the idea, then you don't want to be voting for Brexit.
Well, why would we need it to be under EU control? One of the things I haven't seen that, sir, so I don't know what it is. One of the things I always hear is the fact that the EU stopped wars in Europe for the last 60 years. It's wrong. It's NATO that did it. It was all the American and British troops that did it. We can form alliances with whoever we so choose. We can form alliances with the EU if we so choose. We can form alliances with America, with any of the Commonwealth countries, if we so choose.
We're doing that now.
Yeah. So, there are plans for an EU army. Do you want British military subsumed into an EU army? It's your choice. You've already said it wouldn't be a bad thing, but I suspect many people here.
Yeah, if I can just come in. I think there were two real strategic worries about the military ambitions of the European Union. Up until now, we've been safeguarded by NATO. NATO has also set missions elsewhere to do other jobs, peacekeeping and so on as well. The more that the European Union claims to have an effective military arm, the more likely it is that the Americans might think, oh, the European Union's got an effective military arm, we don't need to bother anymore. And they will pull out of NATO. NATO will either collapse or become an empty shell. That would be fine if the European Union could run military by itself. No country in Europe, in the European Union, puts enough money into its military. No country in the European Union has got a truly effective military, apart from Germany, France, and ourselves. And I think that if America were to pull out, because they thought the European Union could go, that would be a massive strategic error. The other problem, and I think this gentleman here alluded to it, when my father fought in the Second World War, when his father fought in the First World War, they signed up to fight for king and country. Under the European Union system, our servicemen will be sent to die on the casting vote of Latvia, and that's wrong.
Can I just pick up on Jeff's bit about the US not wanting to get that involved in Europe? At this time, the US government has a rolling deployment of US forces in Eastern Europe, okay? And all they do is tour the former Eastern Bloc countries along the border with Russia, okay? So there's no way America will leave Europe. I tell that now, and I've got that straight in the horses now, because I've got some very good friends who are former intelligence officers in the US Army, okay? And that's happening now, and it's not going to stop.
Okay. Yeah. There was a gentleman here, yes, sir.
What we need is a killing argument to persuade people. If you join or sign on to stronger in our opponents, You see, many of the arguments we've heard today are just slightly twisted. I mean, I've got a leaflet from them that says how much money the EU gives us, which is actually what we've paid being returned to us, but stronger in says the EU gives us all this money. So we need an argument that is that can't be answered. And you both mentioned it, but I'm surprised you haven't said more about the fact that the European Parliament isn't actually a parliament.
Yes.
I mean, for a start, it has no control over foreign affairs. So that if there is an EU army, it will not be controlled by our MEP. And that is from the EU Commission's own website. This is not a question of argument. You can see there that the European Parliament has no control over foreign affairs, no control over budgets. It cannot propose legislation. And that's unarguable.
Yes.
That is factual. I use that all the time as the one sentence that you've got in your presentation. I'm curious as to why you don't make more of it, why the national campaigns don't make more of it.
Okay. Whenever I speak, I always bang on about democracy and independence. To my mind, those are the two fundamental things. Without independence and without democracy, we are not masters of our own destiny. I always bang on about it.
But that's not the same thing as saying specifically the European Parliament is a con, if you like.
Oh, yes, yes.
In the same way, those who remember the phrase common market was a con. We must get to the common market, what is it? The European Economic
Union. The fact is, however, sir, that all the research that is being done indicates that while that is a very important issue, the majority of the voting public also want to hear about jobs, they want to hear about investment, they want to hear about international relations, they want to know about security, they want to know. So we can't ignore all those things because the voting public is interested in them, so we have to talk about them.
Yes.
But I do agree with you, you're absolutely right, and as I say, you know, as we said earlier, you know, I was converted when I read the Maastricht Treaty and realised we were no longer a democratic, independent country, and I was horrified. So that's where I come from, and we do have to talk about stuff.
I often do. I try to change my speech every single time. So this time I didn't put it in. But one of the things that always horrifies me is Brussels has over 30,000 registered lobbyists. That's not even in Washington. Those people are the ones who really make the decisions. By the time those laws come to the European Parliament, they're already set in stone. What happens is we sit there in a great big semicircle, 751, I think it was, and then almost without exception, what happens is the main socialist group, the SND, the liberal group, the ALDE, and the European Conservative group, the EPP, they all vote together. And there's a big board up there that shows how you vote, and there's four-fifths of it, in the middle, of all these groups that are supposedly different from each other, they all vote the same way every time, and they all get shuffled through. It's not democratic, you know. We have no say on what happens. We're just there as voting fodder. You can be in Strasbourg, and I'm one of our whips, and I'm in charge of making sure our people know what the votes are going to be on. But we have, some days, 600 votes. And there's no discussion of them. What happens is you sit there and you have a big vote in this like this, and whoever's the president for the day will say 16.43, and you've got three little buttons there, yes, no, or abstain, and you press the button, 16.4.4, you press the button, 16.4.5, you press the button.